family life.
Brilliant wife, brilliant mother, brilliant worker.
When peace returned with motherhood and apple pie, your world contracted to petty parish squabbles, darning socks and endless ironing, a book propped up to liberate your mind, feed dreams of future years when children would be reared. Oh, there's the danger, not under skies raining bombs, but in the quiet disappointment of the laundry room, folding ambition sides to middle.
So these works are about maternal labour and being a mother. The kind of failures and anxiety and mess of being a mother.
At the moment, my work is exploring walking as a performance, and I'm walking as a mother, whether or not I'm with my daughter. Some of that becomes artworks, films, or other live performances. But I was keen to reach out and to engage people who haven't had that experience. So that's where I started to use things like GPS trackers or maps or walking in the landscape.
I'm a filmmaker. I run a film production company working with arts organisations and with charities and with artists. I think my films are a way of me moulding the world around me, that understanding it from all different people's viewpoints.
I would probably describe my work as experimentation. I work across media, so sometimes I do a bit of drawing, a bit of printmaking, or create spaces with people. And to me, I guess it's all about changing perceptions, wanting to see what something looks like if we do something differently.
My creative practice very much went from being extremely physical as a dancer and as an actress and being on stage, and into a practice that's very much smaller and more concentrated. And the themes that I tend to find, it seems so blatantly obvious to say so, but they're very much from my natural environment, from the environment in which I find myself. So it's all my local fields and countryside and plants and trees.
Music is more collaborative thing, and what drives me is a desire to be in groups with other people, and that's what always, when I was younger, being in an orchestra was the best fun I've ever had.
It's partly self-expression, partly a way to get out of my body or my inner world things that are concerning me, and partly as a way of making social change.
It goes from film to painting, because when I did my MA, I just got involved in filmmaking because I'd never tried that before, and I actually found how much I enjoyed it, sampling bits of film and bringing a kind of new sort of narrative, absurdist narrative.
My art practice consists in drawing or found materials, build objects in order to embrace an installation. And these objects and drawings are made from my research in art history or also personal experience under the subject of female body.
What makes me want to do it? What makes me feel the need to do it? I don't know, because surely I would have learned by now I'm not going to make any money out of it.
I'm an occasional poet. I get ideas mostly walking by the sea, or maybe something someone says, or maybe an image, a tree, or a lot of poems maybe for the people I love.
Poetry and gardening. I regard gardening as very creative, and it's also very healing. And if I couldn't have a garden, I think I would really suffer for it.
And then I'll take it to the workshop, to the sheds, a group of six women who meet every Wednesday.
It's a mad thing to do, You know, it's expensive, it's time consuming, and where does it go? I mean, it's just, it is a crazy thing to do. That's how it feels to me. It's a crazy thing to do.
The bit that likes painting is the kind of the toddler, what I call the toddler, who just goes, I actually want to do what I want. I don't want to hook it to anything.
But it's just the thing that really makes me tick, and it's when I'm the happiest, to be honest. I don't know why, it's just better than sex and drugs and rock and roll.
Not wholly Irish, nor fully English, unknowingly Jewish, Catholic of little faith, never Protestant, often protesting. Also a teacher called lecturer, not a proper wife, nor a full-time mother. Human rights activist, writer of poems, though not named poet. On the margin, she watches others mingle, confident, belonging to countries, churches, clubs, the Eostana. Woman of all trades, mistress of none, forget-me-nots, wallflowers, push through cracks in the path leading to her front door.
There's always this impossible balance to be struck between finding time to go to the studio and working a job and having a family life.
You were meant to be brilliant wife, brilliant mother, brilliant worker, you know, not even just good enough. You had to be outstanding in all those roles. And, yeah, it's very hard. That's why I'm so exhausted.
I have to think about really organising my time so that I can work, I can earn money, and then on my time off, when I'm not cleaning the house and taxi driving teenagers and, you know, helping them get a step up on the ladder towards the rest of their lives, then I can make time for myself. Mm. I'm very blessed in that I've got a lot of space. One thing that happens when you live in the arse end of nowhere is you get a lot more options for having a lot of space, but that is very isolating. So I'd say that time is an issue and being isolated is an issue. I don't have a lot of opportunity to work with other artists and get feedback.
I'm sure I'm not the first woman to feel like everything else takes precedent over my personal creative time.
Although there are opportunities to exhibit and to sell and to produce your work, to actually do that and manage to support a family by doing that is kind of, that's beyond my reach.
Some people may think it's selfish, but I think it's essential to my mental well-being and my general well-being, actually.
I don't need to work like I used to have to work. I still need to earn some money, but not nearly as much. And because of that situation, I'm now free to do what I really want to do and what I've always really wanted to do. Quite feeling quite emotional talking about it, actually.
You ask me my source, and I answer, it's love that makes the river run, waterfall, fountains flow over. Love drops rain on purple roses, on poppies' paper blouses, sprinkles dew on the lawn, tears on white pages. When the source runs dry, my land becomes caked mud, barely a trickle in the cracks. I can't find the words. You show me a Chinese landscape of mud flats under the moon, where a lotus flower blooms alone.
I still feel that we are object, not 100% subject yet, and we're in this extraordinary position where we've been subjected to our representation and our mirror image being something that's not quite who we are or what we're supposed to be.
I think that it's a very successful, invisible patriarchy which has created such a strong sense amongst women that they hate their own bodies, that they think their own body
is wrong?
I have worked with children, but a lot with women that were victims of abuse and victims of domestic violence. And as a psychologist when I was living in Chile, and I saw a lot how women have learned to not trust in their intuition, to have no voice. And that's a learning that they have had from their early childhood.
Clarissa Pinkola Estes, she does a lot of work about the power of stories. And I heard an interview with her, and she put it quite succinctly that it's very difficult for women to excel when they are spending so much time worrying about their own bodies.
A girl should be quiet. A girl should respect authority. A woman shouldn't say those words. A woman should cover your body. A woman should be ashamed of her body. And I think that's very powerful.
A woman who thinks that she is hateful is very easy to control.
One thing I think is really, really interesting to talk about is like the hypersexuality or the hypersexuality that there is with pornography and the female subjects that women have to deal with, really, around sex and the objectification of women, which I think is really, you know, just that thing about, you know, how pervasive pornography is, how pervasive kind of really horrendously objectified images of women are in our society.
And what kind of society or world is it that we're bringing our daughters up into when it's completely conventional to have plastic surgery, to have Botox, to have nips and tucks, for probably 99% of older women to dye their hair?
I think on the other hand, though, there's really interesting things that are happening in terms of kind of this generation questioning the whole idea of the binary.
Moving through the world as a woman, you expend a lot of energy just trying to strive for equality, trying to work out whether how you're being treated is fair, fighting against your the socially conditioned upbringing that you had.
So women are included as fully participating members of the community, not just the artistic community. There's still a lot of work to be done.
Mirror, mirror on the wall. My baby's face is not snow white. Her hair is more the raven's wing. But I smell roses in her skin. Now a brooding hen, my daughter, forgets she never wanted children. No more worry about kith and kin. Two eyes drawn from ultrasound, moon morsel cradled in the bubble. You are the fairest of us all. Shadows cross my daughter's face, the hardest days we've ever spent. No power on earth can wake our child from her eternal sleep. Face quiescent, stoic, deep. I cry, how white the winter is. We hold our snow white, say goodbye. Her cradle now a casket. A red rose, wreaths of gorse, yellow on the blackamoor.
My maternal grandmother was quite interesting in that she was a concert pianist, and she grew up in Canada, and she left there and ended up teaching in Japan. And that was like in the early 1900s.
Well, she had this rather suppressed, repressed childhood. She was taken out of school when she was 12 or 13 to look after an older aunt.
Her husband in 1918, so the end of the war, he died when she was really young and she had two children, and she took those children around the world again.
She had a friend, a boy called Arthur, who had a pet owl, pet white owl. And one day when they were both 9, 10, something like that, he was going off to climb trees, so he lent her a pair of his trousers so she could climb the tree with him. And her mother came out of the house and saw them up this apple tree or something and fainted. I mean, she was so horrified, A, that she was wearing trousers, B, that she was up a tree, and C, that she was with a boy.
My dad's mum, she was a painter, and she went to Slade School of Art. When my dad was growing up, they moved around quite a lot. And during one of the moves, his dad threw away all his mum's painting equipment, like all her resources, all her paints. And after that, she fell into alcoholism and into depression, and she died when my dad was a teenager. She literally had her creative outlet taken away from her.
And then my paternal grandmother did work for her father, who owned a supermarket chain in the States. So she had a career. She definitely had a career. She had a career before she married, working for him. That would have been in the 20s. And she was a very strong matriarch.
Because the caste that I'm from are tailors, so that's what everybody was trained in. So she would do a lot of seamstress work at home. And the same for my nan, so my mum's mum. She would do work, paid work at home. I think they'd cook for people and charge, you know, for big weddings and stuff. They would embroider and crochet and knit and make beaded doorway pieces. They were constantly making something.
Her grandfather had said to her parents, if any of your children want to go to university, let me know, because I've got some money put aside for that. So mum, being the eldest and having attained so well, you know, proudly went up to her grandfather and said, you know, I've won this, you know, this amount of accolade, and I think she had some sort of sponsorship to go somewhere, and asked for the remainder of money to go. And he said, oh, no, not women. No, I'll only save the money for men.
Then she left school and she had her voice trained. She had a beautiful singing voice now. And she went for a year to the Manchester School of Music. And then she decided that wasn't very worthwhile, so she went to be a nurse. And she was training as a nurse and going out with my father. In those days, if you got married, you had to give up whatever profession you had, nursing, teaching, whatever. Right up until 1950s in Ireland, there was a marriage ban. So if someone was in civil service or teaching and they got married, they had to give up their jobs.
She also went to art school, and she went to, I think it was King's Cross Station, and she said, I'm just going to take the first train out of here and just see where it takes me to. It took her to Birmingham, and she went to art school in Birmingham. She studied textile design, and there was, in those days, there was a lot of drawing involved with that, and life drawing. And she, when she'd finished that and was together with Dad, she decided that she wanted to have 6 children and then a career. She never went out and worked, you know, as in going out to a studio or a office or anything. She always worked from home where possible. So as the boys grew up, things, you know, she got more and more time, but she always drew. Never stop drawing.